Yeah. I'm chipper, so chipper here in the morning. Great. My name is Yogeshwara Das, and I'm very pleased to be back here in New Ramanreti, beautiful temple, such a beautiful place. And some stuff is always going on here, isn't it? Wait, it's amazing. Rezoning, refinancing, reconfiguring, re-everything. Re-upping the ante, new projects. It's very dynamic. Not like New York. A lot of traffic. Okay, so on behalf of the Association of Geriatric Vaishnavas, I wish to thank you for your hospitality. I'll let you down a secret. Most of us never thought we'd get this far. Those of us who are like, you know, kind of like past 60, like maybe 50, maybe, but 60? That's what's called mercy. And anything goes, by the way. In my classes, you're welcome to jump in and, you know, hurl a cushion at me if I say something you don't like, or, you know, you can ask questions, whatever comes to mind. You're welcome. This is a discussion format. All right, so they've given me this really easy section of the 10th canto to talk about here. Three verses, no less. Texts 21, 22, and 23, is that right? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 22, text 21. Tas
tata
vanata
drishtva
Bhagavan
Devaki
Suta Vasangsi
Tabya
Prayachat
Karunas
Tena
Toshita
Tastata Vanata Drishtva
Tastata Vanata Drishtva
Bhagavan Devaki Suta
Vasangsitabhyak
prayachat
Vasangsitabhyak prayachat
Karunas tena toshita
Karunas tena toshita
Go ahead. Go ahead. No wonder everybody was following along so well. You got it.
Vasangsitabhya
prayachat
Karunas tena toshita
it? Okay. Anyone?
Dasatavanta
drishtva
Bhagavan Devaki Sutaha Pasam Sitavyak Prayachat Karanastena Toshitaha.
Very nice pronunciation.
Dishtva Bhagavan Devaki Sutaha
done. Translation, seeing them bow down like that, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the son of Devaki, gave them back their garments, feeling compassionate toward them and satisfied by their act. Text 22, although the gopis had been thoroughly cheated, deprived of their modesty, ridiculed, and made to act just like toy dolls, and although their clothing had been stolen, they did not feel at all inimical towards Sri Krishna. Rather, they were simply joyful to have this opportunity to associate with their beloved. Purport, Srila Prabhupada comments, this attitude of the gopis is described by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when he prays, my dear Lord Krishna, you may embrace me or trample me under your feet, or you may make me brokenhearted by never being present before me. Whatever you like, you can do, because you have complete freedom to act. But in spite of all your dealings, you are my Lord eternally, and I have no other worshipable object. This is the attitude of the gopis toward Krishna. And then text 23. The gopis were addicted to associating with their beloved Krishna, and thus they became captivated by him. Thus, even after putting their clothes on, they did not move. They simply remained where they were, shyly glancing at him. Purport. By association with their beloved Krishna, the gopis had become more attached to him than ever. Just as Krishna had stolen their clothes, he had also stolen their minds and their love. The gopis interpreted the whole incident as proof that Krishna was also attached to them. Otherwise, why would he have gone to the trouble of playing with them in this way? Because they thought that Krishna was now attached to them, they glanced at him with shyness, and being stunned by the rising of their ecstatic love, they could not move from where they stood. Krishna had overcome their shyness and forced them to come out of the water naked, but now, having dressed properly, they again became shy in his presence. In fact, this incident increased their humbleness before Krishna. They did not want Krishna to see them staring at him, but they cautiously took the opportunity to glance at the Lord. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutade Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swamin Iti Namini Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschacha Desha Tarine. I have no idea what this means. It's way over my head. We know a little bit because Prabhupada has given us extraordinary teachings, and through his teachings we may have some insight into this. But frankly, this is for the Paramahamsas. Did I ever tell you that story? I know, I'm saying this is a new face, I might as well tell it again, it doesn't matter. I was with Prabhupada in Paris. '03 or some long ago time. And I had gone with his secretary Pradyumna to the United Nations office of, it was called Representative Works. Books that were approved as representing a particular culture were received into the UN library, the UNESCO library, United Nations Educational and something or other. And you could put the UN symbol in the book. So we wanted to see if we could get the United Nations symbol for Prabhupada's book, so we went to the office, met this man. It was a room, small room, filled with books. A nice guy, seemed like a nice guy. And we told him what we wanted. We presented him with some of Srila Prabhupada's books, and he seemed to have already been familiar with the book, so it didn't go anywhere, but for one reason or another. He, as a thank you for having visited him, he gave us a copy of poems by Chandidas and Vidyapati. So we brought the book. Prabhupada was in Paris at the time. We had a small house in the suburbs, and we brought him the book. and handed him this book of poems. And he glanced through the book and said, "Where'd you get this?" So we explained. And then he, said, "Okay, thank you." About 10 minutes later, I hear Yogeshwar, and he called me into his room. He said, "These poems by Chandidasa Vidyapati, they're for a very, very, very advanced class of devotees, for the Paramhamsas. You all know what Paramhamsa means? Does anybody not know what the word Paramhamsa means? Raise your hand. Very advanced group here. Okay. All right. So, these swan-like devotees who just live above all the material contamination." And he said, "This is not for general distribution." He said, "Listen to this." And he quoted this, the following verse to me. "Harshness at home hurts me like a burn. How long can I bear to be a girl in another's power? It is the sickness of love that has been my disease, and now it is the cure that kills me." So I'm 19 years old, I'm listening to this stuff. I don't know how to put a dhoti on, let alone understand these poems. And he says, "So that other girl," this is a married woman speaking, "and that other power, that's Krishna. So we're condemning illicit sex. And if we were to publish these poems, people would say we're hypocrites. Because here we're glorifying a married woman's love for Krishna, who is not her husband." He said, "I went to my spiritual master one time. My spiritual master went to his father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, one time, and said, 'I'd like to publish poems by Chandidas and Vidyapati.' And Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, 'No, they're too advanced. No one would understand this stuff. They would misinterpret it as immoral behavior.' So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati went away, and then he came back again and said, 'You know, I think there's a lot of important philosophy in these poems by Chandidas and by Vidyapati, and we really should publish them. They're going to be lost.' Bhaktivinoda again refused. He said, 'No, you can't do it. It'll be not only will it be misinterpreted, people will grow to hate Krishna because they'll say he's immoral. So you cannot publish.' When Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati came back for a third time, Bhaktivinoda Thakur looked at his son and said, 'All right, you can publish. One copy for yourself.'" And then Prabhupada looked up at me and said, "Where's the great devotee who can understand such poems?" And at that time, not really understanding how averse Srila Prabhupada was to praise, I kind of naively said, "Well, there's only you. There's only you who can understand." And he went like this. He said, he dropped his head and he waved his hand in front of me like that. He said, "No. I may not be that great. I'm not that great." So even Srila Prabhupada presented himself as incapable of understanding such pastimes between Krishna and the gopis. So what can we say about them? Frankly, in this lifetime at least, I don't think I've ever been a woman, but if I were, and if a guy ever treated me like this, I'd walk away. Seriously. Like, what do you think? He steals your clothes, makes you walk naked in front of him, embarrasses you, humiliates you, makes fun of you, lies to you. And then when you say, "I'm going to go tell the king," he says, "He's an old man. I don't care. Go do what you want to do." I mean, that's not the kind of thing that would normally endear someone to a beloved, embarrassing you in front of your friends. So it's a mystery. It's a real mystery how this is the highest level of ecstatic love of God. Well, welcome to Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is not easy problems with easy solutions. We may sometimes, print a book like that, easy questions, easy answers. But the fact of the matter is, it is the most complex questions with impossible answers. We like problems. Why do we like problems? We like problems because problems have solutions, right? Here's the problem, here's the solution, bang, you put them together and get on with the rest of your day. Not everything lends itself to that kind of simple dealing, especially in spiritual life. Some things in life, we might call them dilemmas. A dilemma is something that doesn't lend itself to a simple solution. How to fix a car engine is a problem that has a solution. how to repair a relationship, that's a dilemma. And the most you can hope for there is maybe some forward movement, some gradual forward movement. Beyond problems, beyond dilemmas, we come to a yet deeper level of impasse. We might call that mystery, the mystery of Krishna. And if the response to a problem is a solution, if the response to a dilemma is some forward movement, the only possible response to mystery is awe, you know, and eventually love. You know, that, I don't understand you, Krishna. I have no idea what you're doing. I surrender to you. So it's kind of the diametric opposite of how people live in the world. People live wanting to solve the problem. You know, unfortunately, we don't live in the kind of world where doing the right thing solves the problem, you know, or where living a good life is rewarded. We'd like to think that. We'd like to think we live in a world where, you know, if you live a good life and you know, then at least that's the propaganda that we hear from childhood. You know, behave, follow the rules. Doesn't work like. Look at this Trayvon Martin case. Are you familiar with what's going on? I mean, the whole country is up in arms about this poor young man who was killed by this fellow Zimmerman. Who we will never know what really happened. There were no witnesses, except hearsay in his own testimony to say why he shot this young man. But it has polarized the country, you know, into what is self-defense and what is racism. You know, this is the 21st century, and from my friends of color, as we sometimes say, you know, blacks, Hispanics, others, you know, the fact is that if you're a young person growing up in the United States today and you're of color, you know, you're not mainstream white, there'll come a time in your growing up when your parents, or many parents, not all parents, but many parents will tell you, if you're stopped by a cop, you're in your car, you're driving, and a cop stops you for speeding, and you know you were going under the speed limit, don't argue. Don't argue. Because you're going to get beat up, thrown in jail, or dead. That's a harsh reality. So, you know, obeying the rules does not always lead to, you know, a good end. This is the material world, and things are unpredictable here. What is Krishna consciousness? In many respects, learning to live with uncertainty. When we were first getting started as devotees, Prabhupada used to say something like, well, just chant and be happy. Oh boy, did he get us. Yeah, chant and be happy. What he didn't tell us was the other side of that. That if you keep chanting, the complexity of our predicament as embodied souls will reveal itself, and then just start breathing. That's when you're, you know, ujjayi breathing, if you're doing yoga. That's when that breathing starts really coming in useful. Breathe into it, because it ain't going to be easy. There are no simple solutions. There may be temporary simple solutions, but there are no permanent simple solutions. So Krishna consciousness, in many regards, means coming to accept and be comfortable with uncertainty. How to live with uncertainty. You don't know what the future is going to be. There are no, unfortunately, there are no promises. It's not that you can come here, you know, put on the neck beads, you know, go to the store and buy your sari or your dhoti, get your japa, you know, get to the program, and then there'll be a contract that you sign which says, starting next week, life will be simple. It just doesn't work that way. It's very complex. And as far as I've understood, I'm whatever I am now, 63 or something, my understanding of faith, the idea of faith in Krishna and the spiritual master, is faith that behind the uncertainty, there's a deeper story going on. There's always a deeper story. That's why you don't judge things by appearances. because our senses only see the surface. Beyond that, there's a deeper story going on. Always, 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 always. That's why you can't judge people. Don't look at somebody and judge them. I look at my granddaughter. You know, I have a tendency to judge her because she's so handicapped in so many ways, you know. Then if I look closer, I realize I watch her interacting with her parents, right? She's communicating. She's talking with them, you know, and she's explaining things to them, probably very wise things, but I can't understand it, you know. And then she'll be quiet. Then she'll stop. I wish I had that ability to just stop talking. You know, I'm just like, yeah, yeah, yeah. She'll talk for a while, and then she'll stop. When she said what she's finished saying what she had to say, she'll just stop. She'll be there. There's something much deeper going on there, just beyond the, you know, facts of the physical and neurological damage that's been done. There's something so much deeper going on. Anyway, things deeper going on here too in this 10th canto. I just can't really explain them to you. One thing we can, well, here's what we can say about this very deep philosophy and stories about Krishna and the Gopi, is that Krishna is not the god of institutional religion, that's for sure. The British made their way into India, what, late 1600s, something like that, British East India Company. First they started trading, and back home in London, Parliament was saying, well, don't get involved in their religion. That's not our business. We're just there for trade. Then after a while, the missionaries made the case that, no, we have an imperative as Christians to bring the light of Jesus into these people's lives. I mean, look at them. Just seeing the surface. They didn't understand the story behind that. Look at them. Look what they're doing. They're worshiping idols. Look at their gods. Particularly in the writings of the British missionaries, it was particularly Krishna that they singled out. Particularly Krishna. Because he's the one who's, you know, I mean, look at the paintings around, you know. Look what he's doing with the gopis. He's spraying water and dancing. So the British said, you know, of all the religions of the contaminated mind of man, this Krishna worship is the worst of all. They had no idea what they were looking at. So this is the most complex level of theology, you know. What's going on beneath the surface there is so deep, it's so profound. And Krishna is not that god of institutional religion who conforms to your idea of what is moral behavior. You may have an idea of what's moral. Krishna has his idea. So we don't know. There's a spontaneity to Krishna, to his interactions with his devotees. There's something that is unpredictable about it. Again, becoming comfortable with unpredictability. That's the relationship that Krishna has with his devotees. You can't plot that on a graph, you know, on a computer software. Now Krishna is going to do this and then he's going to do that. You have no idea. Here's a mundane parallel. I'm a fan of the architecture of Frank Gehry. I don't know if you know who he is. He did the Disney auditorium in California. He did some extraordinary museums. You'll recognize Gehry's work because it's very, very energetic and this explosive energy of design. There aren't any right angles anywhere. You'll have soaring loops of metallic structures and stone structures and ceramic structures that just kind of go all over the place. And, you know, you're kind of absorbed into it. This is an amazing experience of approaching a Frank Gehry creation. And the late film director Sidney Pollack was a friend of his. Pollack one day went into his studio with a camera and he wanted to film his friend Gehry at work. You can get this on YouTube somewhere. And so Gehry, who's sitting there with his assistant, he's got a young assistant with paper, scissors, and scotch tape, right, sitting there. And Gehry is kind of this Einsteinian-looking guy with, you know, hair everywhere. And what has he got? He's got this cardboard shape of a building that he's supposed to design. And it's got these two flared ends, very Gehry. But in the middle, it's just a flat wall. So he's looking at that, and he's just like staring at it, meditating. What to do? So he points to his assistant and says, fold up a piece of paper like an accordion. So the camera goes to the assistant. He's folding and folding and folding. And Gary says, all right, now stretch it out and tape it in the middle. So his assistant takes that piece of, sticks it in there with put tape, and Gary's looking at him. And he looks up at Pollock and says, that's so ugly. And he looks at it again, and he points to his assistant. And he says, cut out all but three folds. So the assistant takes it down, and he cuts it up with scissors, and he stretches it out and sticks it back in that hole and tapes it in place. And Gary's looking at it, and his eyes, his pupils start to dilate. You know, and his face starts to brighten, and he sits up straighter. And he looks up at the camera, and he says to Pollock, he says, do you see how that works now? And his hands shoot up in the air, yahoo, like this, you know. And what you're watching there is the act of creation in the moment. You're seeing spontaneity happen. To my feeble way of thinking, That comes close to describing the relationships that souls have with Krishna. You don't know until you're in the moment what's going to happen. Because the world around you is changing every second. Your own thought patterns are changing at every second. Krishna is changing every second. The circumstances you're dealing with are constantly evolving and shifting. And what happens in that moment, that spontaneous response to the call to creativity, has something for me to do with the heart of devotional life. So we cleanse our heart with the chanting and following the principles, so that in that moment, the choice you make is one that springs from love. But you don't know what it is. You can't, there's no script for this. So we follow regulative principles, that's called Vaidhi Bhakti, so that we get to what? What do we get to when you follow the regulative principles? What's, huh? Spontaneous, Raganuga Bhakti. What is spontaneous? Spontaneous means you don't know. You have no idea what you're going to do. I'll see when I get there. I'm done. Any questions? Yeah.
Thank you, Yogeshwar, for that, moment of creation that you shared with us. Is there... what I'm trying to understand is the difference between doing and being. Do we do that moment, or do we just be that moment of creativity? Is it something that comes from our works, or is it something that comes from someplace else, grace and the Christian tradition?
Well, there's something poetic in the question itself, and I thank you for that. When my son and I walked into the temple room a little earlier, I looked at the deities, and I this is embarrassing, but I'll admit this to you. It took me about 15 minutes to realize what was going on, that I was in the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the chanting is going on, and I'm looking around, I'm seeing who I know, you know. And then I said, stop, just be here in the moment. Stop doing and start being. So maybe in that sense, you know, it's the same doing, but you're so committed to that, you're so focused and attentive to it, that it's not different from who you are. You know, in that moment, there's no distraction. So maybe doing and being become the same thing at some moment. You know, to really focus on looking on such beautiful deities, and then realizing that this isn't some, you know, ritual. It's ritual, but it's if you allow it to go deeper, it's darshan, you know, it's a vision of God. So maybe it becomes the same. Yeah. What's your name? Bhakti Lata? Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, thank you for your very fresh class. I had a question. You were saying that if we study Krishna's pastimes of the gopis and even the rasa dance and these dynamics, it's very difficult to understand because, you know, we shouldn't follow that. And I just have a question because in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, whatever acts that a great man performs, all the world pursues, kind of that quote about how a man, he sets the example. And I think in my life, I'm always looking for examples of people in my spiritual life, and even material life. Oh, they've accomplished this. So Krishna's like, oh, I must work, because if I stopped working, the world would follow me. And so I must keep working because they're following my example. So there's that aspect that Krishna's saying, oh, you know, you need to follow my example. And then there's this other aspect that, like, don't even look at what he's doing there because you don't want to follow that example of how he's interacting with married women and, you know, like that. So what's the balance between the two of finding an example in Krishna and also and not just arbitrarily saying, okay, I'm not going to follow him on this regard, but I'll follow him on this regard.
My daughter's probably about your age. She's 23. And she's a bit of a liberation theologian. You know, I think if she has an objection to Krishna consciousness, it's the role of women. We have to make the distinction, the difference between what happens on that elevated platform, that behavior, and the example that's needed for most people in this world. It seems like a double standard, you know, which is probably why there's more than one avatar. You know, Krishna came as Rama, right? It's like middle of the road, you know? It didn't break any rules. Well, theoretically, didn't break any rules. Krishna's advent, his purpose in being here, to show that rules alone are not where it's at. He tells Arjuna that, actually, in the Gita. He says, you're going to reach a point in your Krishna consciousness where all the scriptural rules and regulations, you're going to become rather indifferent to that stuff. The trick is not to pretend that we're beyond that level of following a moral life, a good life, and acknowledging that there may be some higher standard of morality, if you will, where immorality becomes morality. Immorality on the spiritual platform is transcendent morality because it is whatever Krishna wants. You know, thy will be done, you know, whatever you wish. But the guidelines for people on that level are very, very different. They're not the same. So people who do what you're pointing at, which is if we're supposed to follow Krishna's example, that's what ends up with the Sahajya groups and people kind of taking liberties with Krishna's behavior as a rationalization for their own immoral behavior. And it's also why, going back to the British, this is interesting, when the British studied the Sanskrit texts, they divided them into two parts. There's the nice Krishna, you know, the Krishna on the field of battle. He's a moral guy, right? He's giving good teachings, he's dharma, you know, ahimsa, you know, all that. Then you've got the Krishna of the Bhagavatam. That's the bad Krishna. So we're not going to go there. Krishna of the Gita, good. Krishna of the Bhagavatam, bad. Because they, you know, didn't understand that spiritual life takes place in progressive stages, and you have to know what stage you're at. Be honest about your own stage of spiritual advancement. Look, the students at my weekly class up at Jiva Mukti, I think, get kind of tired of hearing me say this. We're in this training to become agents of change in the world. We're meant to go out into the world and make a difference. Whatever our particular sphere of influence is, it may be local, it may be on a world I once interviewed Stephen J. Rockefeller at a conference of religious leaders. He's a practicing Buddhist. And I can be a little, you know, edgy when I interview people. So I said, what's it like to be a Rockefeller? And he was a gentleman. He took it politely. He said, well, some of us are called upon to play out our role in the world on a grand stage, on an international stage. Others of us on a smaller, more modest stage. And then he said something very wise. He said, but who's to say which is more important? He says, our responsibility, our duty is to take the opportunities that are there before us and make the most of them. So whatever your sphere of influence may be, it may be very large, it may be very small, you know, you can affect change. In order to do that, you have to be an example. That's yad yada charitrishtas. What is the example you can be that will be of positive influence to the community around you, your sphere of influence? That means being very honest and open about, you know, where you're at spiritually. And then, again, faith means knowing that just you follow these principles, and the cleansing that takes place eventually will prepare you for that other door to that other level of what goes on with, you know, the Paramahamsas. That will open to you. You don't have to, you know, Krishna consciousness is not like you're on a merry-go-round and you're grabbing for a gold ring, you know. It's something that's there. It will be revealed at the proper time. When we're capable of negotiating it properly, it will be given to us. I don't know if that answers your question. But so-so. Well, it's a good question. You have to be prepared for uncertain answers.
Just to continue her question, Sukadeva Goswami asks almost the same question to Parikshit, and he answered that great controllers should not be imitated. They can, in fact, he says how the Lord can dance with all the men's wife in the night, and then Sukadeva Goswami says that great controllers should not be imitated. They're not on the same level like us. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's not a great man shown an example. He's more than that. He can take all of our heads off in a minute and put them back together, disappear all of us and reappear us back. So by understanding his position, then we can get a better perspective of the past tense itself. Mm-hmm. He is even beyond Lord Ramachandra too, who was given a good example as a king and so forth. But Lord Krishna's position is much more than that.
Right. It's a wonderful reflection. Thank you for that. With one reservation, if you will. What's your name? Trivikram. Thank you, Prabhu. I have one reservation. When Parikshit Maharaj talks about the great leaders and how they're above the rules, that was the Vedic time. That you cannot apply today. The other hat that I wear is I teach at Hofstra University, and I'm a little sensitized to war crimes issues. And there's been this history of leaders of state taking refuge behind a mantle of executive exemption, executive immunity, that state leaders cannot be tried, no matter how grievous their crimes. Thank goodness that's changing. Only within the last few years we've been able to take leaders from Uganda, Rwanda, elsewhere, Darfur, and bring them before the bench of the International Criminal Court in The Hague to stand trial for crimes against humanity, genocide, etc., despite their being a head of state. So we live in different times today, And I think we have to be very careful about just blanketly applying the idea that rulers and heads are above the law. That's not true. That's no longer true. Thank goodness. But your point still is well made, that Krishna is above all such considerations. In fact, the other part of the answer that was given there, and it's a wonderful one, is that if all living beings are expansions of Krishna's energy, and if he decides, and he's in everyone's heart, if he steps outside of their heart to dance with them, what's immoral about that? They're his own energies. And the example is given of a child playing with her reflection in a mirror. There's nothing immoral about a child playing with the reflection in the mirror. It's her own reflection. So if Krishna decides to dance with the gopis, they're his own energies. There's nothing immoral about that. It's immoral in this world because we attempt to control, possess, enjoy, abuse, appropriate someone who is totally separate from us. We have no rights over them, and yet we act as though we do. That makes it immoral. So do we have another couple of minutes? Or? Yes. What's your name, Prabhu?
Mahabhuti Das.
Mahabhuti. Thank you.
There was one, word in the translation that I think we can zero in on. Not the translation, but in the purport, where Krishna says that the gopis were addicted to Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I read something that was posted to Facebook the other day where Prabhupada had a conversation with a gentleman. I don't know if he was Indian or not. I can't remember exactly. But he approached Prabhupada and he asked him, who can I ask to become my spiritual master? And Prabhupada says, find that personality, that Vaishnava, that is most addicted to Krishna. So we as spirit souls are basically automatically an addictive personality. We've been in the spiritual sky. We have been addicted to Krishna. We've come here rebellious against that, whatever it was. But we're still an addictive personality. So we attach our addiction to material things instead of spiritual things. The process of cleansing the mind and wiping the mirror of the heart is to reattach our addiction to Krishna. At least that's the way I see it.
Very nice. Thank you. Very relevant comment. Yeah.
Thank you, Shifuru.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to ask you if any of your lectures at, or classes at Jiva Mukti are available online, or are they recorded, or are they available?
Yeah, well, it's a little embarrassing in front of the deities and Prabhupada, but yes. On YouTube, there are downloads, Gita Wisdom, something like that. Ask me later. Podcast? Not YouTube, podcast. See what? I got this stuff down. Is that a hand? Okay. What's your name?
Let me check. Stita D.
Hare Krishna.
When I walked in, fool's rush in, right? When I walked in, it sounded like you were responding to a question about gender roles.
About?
Gender roles.
Gender roles.
Is that what the question was?
The question was regarding the verse in the Gita, Yad Yad Acharati Sestas. And if Krishna is an example whom we're supposed to follow, how do we reconcile that with his behavior with the gopis? Am I... Is that right? Is that more or less the question? Yeah?
It just jogged a question I had, but that's right. Quite applied.
And the answer is, with great difficulty.
Yeah, that's a good way to answer all those questions.
We have no idea what we've gotten ourselves into here. We have no idea. This is so profound, this Krishna consciousness. It's so deep. We're just skimming the surface. We have such a beginner's understanding of what's going on. It unfolds and unfolds and unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. It never stops. Prabhupada wrote me a letter one time, 1970, 71. He said, "You're very enthusiastic, therefore you're going to go back to Godhead in the near future." I was ready to stop there. The next sentence was, "So therefore don't stop. You go on." He says, "Krishna consciousness is like an ocean. You keep swimming and you'll never find any end to it. So keep swimming." Yes, hand. Two hands. And then there's one in the back as well.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. What's your name?
Leela Manjari.
Leela Manjari. These great names here.
Mercy of the Guru. I appreciated you speaking about the importance of following the rules and regulations and establishing that so that we can be prepared to enter into a stage of Raghunuga, into spontaneity. And on my beginning level, I'm always worried about offenses. And mm-hmm. in my heart, I was stirred to ask, when I come into the presence of a Vaishnav who's taken these steps and entered into this stage, there's a tendency to not immediately realize where that Vaishnav is at, and that the fault falls onto yourself when I find fault in others. And I'm wondering if you might be able to help me and help me understand how to avoid this offense.
Yeah, it's tricky. That's the message of the class, if you haven't picked up. Everything's tricky. Nothing's simple. Why is it tricky? Because, you know, a kind of a pat answer would be to say, well, we're humble toward everyone. Right? That's, you know, kind of like the party line. Let's be humble. Be humble to everyone. Because any devotee, anyone who chants Hare Krishna, they're a devotee. We bow at their feet. Right. Okay. Time out. Who's the better devotee? Someone who has technically received initiation by an approved guru in the lineage, but whose habits are yuck, and who has very little interest in really making spiritual progress, or someone who may have no intellectual understanding whatsoever of Radha and Krishna and Vrindavan and that whole world, but whose whole life is given over to God and wanting to serve God by doing good to others? Who's the better devotee? So, you know, we've got to go into this, you know, with our heads wide open about, you know, those protocols. Of course we're courteous to everyone, because the fact is we don't know. You look at Nityananda Mahaprabhu, an avidute, you know, you look at him, you go, this crazy person. You know, so you don't know just by judging external behavior. At the same time, we don't want to be naive. You know, and just, some people you should just stay away. You know, you really should. That's common sense. Don't on the plea of, you know, Vaishnav courtesy, if you're putting yourself in a dangerous position or an awkward position, that's not spiritual, that's silly. So you know, use that discerning ability to know. And just be polite about it. You know, sorry, I'm yeah.
I don't have a question. I just have a comment. We can't thank you enough for coming here. We can't thank you enough for being Srila Prabhupada's disciple. We can't thank you enough for joining the movement. We can't thank you enough for your example. Thank you so very much, and we love your humor.
Everything, that's because you're seeing with loving eyes. I remember I was with Prabhupada in Paris, and he was playing, and I was harmonium and singing, and I was playing kartals, I think. And afterwards, he finished recording the song, and I looked at him and said, "Prabhupada, you have such a beautiful voice." You know, it was really, you know, like eyelids fluttering. Kind of. And he looked at me and said, "Padmalocham." What does that mean? Like a mother has a child who's blind, but because there's love there, she calls her child lotus-eyed. And he says, "You love me, so you say I have a beautiful voice." Thank you very much. That was very, very thoughtful. Are we done?
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I was listening on the radio, and then I had to come and get in my car, so I missed a little part when you were answering Bhakti Lata's question. And I wonder if you could repeat what you must have said to make the distinction between following and imitating, because I didn't hear that part.
Well, I'd preface it by saying a good man nowadays is hard to find. I have utmost sympathy for people looking to partner, you know, because you want someone who's a good example, and then you find out, well, gosh, you know, are you looking for a spiritual master, and you never know, you know, it's like everything's so tentative, and, you know, who's a good example, and whose example to follow. The technical point that I was making to Bhakti Lata was that, you know, in India people use Krishna's example as an excuse for sahaja behavior. So you have, you know, that's an extreme. Okay, I asked Prabhupada one time, I said, you know, in your books you say we should follow in the footsteps of the gopis. Do you mean that? Literally? I mean, that, you know. And he said, "Oh, that's very nice, you know, if you want to do that. But you have to be completely free of all material desire." He said, "So right now you should read the books." He said, and specifically he mentioned, read Chaitanya Charitamrita and Chaitanya Bhagavat. Now he had not translated Chaitanya Bhagavat, but he said we should read Chaitanya Bhagavat. I'm not going to get into a whole discussion about which books to read, which books not to read, and that's another controversy. But his point was study, so that you know what the standard is. Don't always rely on someone else. You know, I mean, sure, should we be appreciative of exalted Vaishnavas who have reached some elevated... Absolutely. That's not a substitute for you using your own brain and understanding what's the right thing to do. That was the big mistake we made in the first generation. Ooh, wow, did that get us in trouble. We just, you know, we want to surrender our free will to somebody else and just let them tell us what to do. Just tell me what to do. You know? No. All right, I'll tell you what to do. Start thinking for yourself. You know, you've got God-given intelligence. It's meant to be exercised. So ultimately, Bhakti Lata and others, you know the answer. You know the answer. You know it within your own heart. Ishvara sarva bhutanam, Krishna says, "I'm in your heart." He's giving that dictation. You'll know. You know, if you're sincere, you'll know what's the right standard, what to do, what not to do. It's not an impossible feat. Are we done? Yes.
Said, "Let me be here for the moment." I address the deity sometime, and I find the same, my mind is all over the universe, but if I pull it and I said, "My God, I'm in the presence of the Supreme Personality of God," I notice my consciousness changed so dramatically.
Yeah.
You know, of course, it's hard to maintain that for, you know, you address the deities for an hour, but it's such a difference in consciousness when you're there for the moment, but it's so hard to maintain that. How do you do that?
Well, that's Krishna's question to him. That's Arjuna's question to Krishna, isn't he? He says, you know, "My mind is like the wind. I can't possibly control it." What is the one thing that can control the mind? What is the one state, the one emotion that's so powerful that no matter how flickering your mind, no matter how easily you're distracted by things, You'll never wander. What is that one? This is a set-up question here. What's that one emotion that conquers everything? Duh. So if you love the deity, your mind will never wander because it will have no reason to wander. The mind wanders because it's unsatisfied. The mind will be completely satisfied when it's reposed at Krishna's lotus feet. So if the love is there, then job done. You're home. All right, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.